Hello, I'm Dominic Green. I'm Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, and welcome to our weekly Life and Arts podcast. My guest this week is the poet Alicia Stallings. Born in Georgia, resident in Athens, this year Stallings has published two collections of verse, one of them a translation of Hesiod's Works and Days, and the second, her third volume of verse, Like. Alicia Stallings, welcome to Spectator USA.
Thank you.
So to begin at the beginning with Hesiod, what draws you to him, other than that he may have been the first poet to have been aware of himself as a poet?
Well, it turns out I'm interested in epic didactic poems.
Of course.
Which are not maybe the most fashionable thing, but I had translated Lucretius, who again is... trying to persuade with his poem about a philosophy. And Hesiod is part of that tradition. He's sort of the beginning of that tradition. But I am intrigued with him as the first personality in Western literature. I think nobody really knows, who is first, Homer or Hesiod. That's an ancient debate in and of itself. But for the ancients, Hesiod was the earlier poet. And we can never know who Homer was or whether it's even one person. But Hesiod talks a lot about himself and gives us the first bio in literature.
Excellent.
And of course, since it's the first bio in literature, we not only get, who his antecedents are and where he, grew up, but we get the fact that he won a major prize. So poetry hasn't really changed that much in this time period.
So one of the difficulties of understanding old poetry is understanding the ambience in which it was originally written and heard. And so for that purposes, I've got a field recording of some cicadas recorded at Delphi, not at the actual temple sites, but in the garden of a nearby hotel. So before you read the Hesiod, cue the ambience.
So in the original, this is around line 582, he's talking about the different times of year to do things, but then he goes into these lyric moments where he just describes winter or describes summer. So this is his little summer lyric. When thistle blooms and loud cicada rings in a tree and shrills from underneath his wings, clear, ceaseless song in toilsome summertime, that's when she-goats are fattest, wine is prime, women are lustiest, and men instead are at their weakest, parched in knees and head by Sirius, and the heat's made their skin dry. Then let there be a shady rock nearby and bibline wine, some good baked bread to eat, cheese from goats just drying up, some meat from a forest browsing cow with never a calf, and also meat from firstling kids, then quaff some fire-bright wine stretched in that shady place, and when you've had your fill and turned your face into the fresh west wind, make offering from an ever-flowing, clear, untroubled spring, pour three parts water to one part of wine.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's a timeless feel that you've achieved there, but of course you wrote it in a particular time and place and in an entirely different language. How do you approach something like this, to move from ancient Greek and ancient Greece into modern English?
Well, I think there is a kind of interesting aspect to be translating it in Greece. Sometimes that helps me understand a scene or a place better. I've been out in the evening with the cicadas, and also in terms of, there's some geographical jokes in the poem, which I think if I were in the States, I wouldn't really have understood as much as being in Greece. The fact that I'm hearing a lot of the same words, just on the street. And I started translating this really at the beginning of the economic crisis. And it was sort of shocking to me that this archaic poem, which I had long thought of as, you know, kind of dry and fusty and old-fashioned, was really speaking to the moment. The same words, kreos, which is debt, kerdos, which is gain or profit, emporia, trade and market, all of these are exactly the same in modern Greek and were in, you know, the newspapers and so forth with basically the same meaning that Hesiod had. Chrimata is kind of interesting because that's also the modern Greek for money. And I translate it in my translation as money. And I think Hesiod is thinking of it much as we think of money, except money didn't exist then. So I had to put a footnote for that one. It hadn't quite been invented yet. But in some ways, it seemed really strangely to speak to what was going on. It's really concerned with debt and with justice and with work. And those were the same kind of concerns that we were hearing about constantly in Athens in that period.
As we have the cicadas, would it be possible to hear some of the original Hesiod in the original tongue and then a little part of your translation?
Yes, so I will read a couple of lines. This is where Hesiod is talking about how much poets hate other poets. Again, something that holds up well over time.
I was going to think, plus ça change. Yeah.
So this is in Dactylic Hexameter in the Greek. And so that's a kind of flexible line which can range from 13 to 17 syllables, but it always ends on the same bump, 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 bump. And I think what I like about these lines is you can hear the loathing and the hatred in the lines. Ke keramevs kerame kotei ke tekton tekton ke tohos ptoho phthonei ke aidos aido. It just sounds like he's almost spitting.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely plosive and sharp, and like I was thinking of bits of ceramic pottery or something like that. It's a sharp-edged sound. Can we hear that now in English to see how it sounds in that?
He's talking about the two kinds of strife. There's a constructive strife, competition, as it were, that leads people to try harder and do better. And there's destructive strife, which leads to war and violence. But he's talking now about the good strife. This strife is boon to man, and that's why in this life potter hates potter, builder has no regard for builder, nor beggar, beggar, bard loathes bard.
So I can hear some echoes of that explosive sound, the K's, but you've moved into B's.
Yes, yes. So yes, so in the Greek it's those PTs and thos, and it's very plosive.
Are you also trying, but you don't move across the rhyme scheme or the rhythm? You have to find another one in English. Isn't that always the problem of moving between a language? You can't really replicate the original rhythmic pattern because it's just a different language.
It is a different language, and it's partly that Dactylic Hexameter is spectacularly not useful in English. Hexameter tends to fall flat. Alexander Pope has a famous line about it's, you know, like a wounded snake dragging its slow length along. So hexameters don't work terribly well in English anyway. But the other thing is that the Greek is very swift because Greek is polysyllabic, so you can have a line that only has a couple of words in it, yet it has 17 syllables. You know, and whereas English is quite monosyllabic. So you have to find something that will give the sense of a didactic poem, a long didactic poem, without, you know, using the hexameter. So I opted for rhymed iambic pentameter couplets. Of course, Hesiod doesn't rhyme, but I think rhyme works well with that sort of aphoristic, Hesiodic, you know, early to bed, early to rise, makes a man healthy, yes, wealthy, and wise. That kind of aphoristic, yes, element of Hesiod, I think rhyme works well. And the iambic pentameter, the model I ended up kind of thinking about, someone who would sound in English a bit like Hesiod. Hesiod was famous for having a sort of middle style, you know, not very high, not very low, and for a sort of sweetness. And he's got this kind of countrified Boeotian air to him, where he's more sophisticated than he lets on. He's sort of, you know, he's talking about being a farmer, but he knows all of that.
Who would his parallel figures be in English or American literature then?
Well, I think for me, I decided that Robert Frost was hitting a lot of those same points, where he is, you know, in a sense, a Boeotian poet. If we think of poets as Athenian or Boeotian, Robert Frost is north of Boston, as it were. Someone who's writing, you know, outside the centers of academia. And, you know, again, he's got that sort of middle style where he throws in the occasional archaism. He kind of seems to be a simpler person than he is. You know, there's this sort of affectation of countryness. So I felt that was kind of the tone that I was looking for.
The ancient Greeks went out into the world, and the crisis and its aftermath has driven a new generation of young modern Greeks out of Greece in search of work or opportunity. At the same time, the world has come to Greece through a very long migrant crisis. And I know that this has also been part of your daily life as well, while you were working on Hesiod.
Yes, that was another aspect where I realized that some things that were happening now have always been happening. Part of Hesiod's biography is that he is the son of an economic migrant. So his father is from Asia Minor, current Turkey, really just off of the coast of Lesbos.
Which is exactly where people have been.
Which is where all of these migrants who are coming by the sea route are getting in these very treacherous little dinghies and coming across from Turkey to Lesbos. Well,
yeah, some of a lot of these dinghies look like things which are sold at tourist shops, you know, in beach resorts.
Yeah, they're not seaworthy boats, and it's actually one of the really traumatizing memories that people have is getting on, you know, these overcrowded, unseaworthy boats. They're often given hardly enough fuel to make it to Greek waters. And it just struck me again and again that this route that people are traveling has been a route since the Bronze Age, since before the Bronze Age. I mean, there's been this population flow in both directions since ancient times. And Hesiod is really part of that. So Hesiod, he's the son of an economic migrant. And, you know, he talks about his father came there because not because he was fleeing wealth or prosperity, but because he was fleeing poverty. So he's this sort of failed merchant seaman. And he comes to mainland Greece and Boeotia, of course, traditionally, even, you know, I think in English, Boeotian has this meaning of sort of out in the sticks, the back of beyond. And Hesiod talks about, you know, and I ended up in this wretched village. You know, it's not pleasant in summer. It's not pleasant in winter. It's not nice any time of the year, which, you know, Asker doesn't have that. Modern Asker doesn't have that on their tourist brochures. But so I felt like this was very interesting that he was part of this timeless migration that is still going on. And in fact, my husband and I, we've spent a lot of time driving through Boeotia kind of while I was doing this translation, but also there's this farm now that some refugees have founded in Boeotia, and they are from places like, you know, Iran, Iraq, Syria, and it's just interesting that they've come to Boeotia and are farming just almost exactly as Hesiod's father had done. So some things just keep happening.
Isn't there one of the Latin writers says, for a long time the Syrian Orontes has flowed into the Tiber, talking about how, you know, populations move, especially within empires and into them.
Yes.
And
yes.
Of course, the difference being perhaps that the Greek state itself hasn't been able to function, hasn't been able to help people, and the imperial power, which is the European Union, hasn't had the budgets or the political organisation to take control of the situation either. Has it then fallen back on the kindness of ordinary people, in effect? The state has depended upon the hospitality of the Greek people to accommodate this huge flow of migrants and refugees.
Well, I think what we've seen, and, I'm speaking as a poet and a volunteer, my husband's the journalist side of the family, but I think what we've seen is that a lot of the grassroots organizations or ordinary volunteers, solidarity groups, have actually been quite efficient, whereas some of the larger NGOs have not. And there have been a lot of failures on the state level, on the NGO level, and a lot of times it has come down to, volunteers. And it's been interesting because that sort of volunteer and solidarity world, as it were, partly sprang up to deal with the Greek crisis, where people realized the state wasn't going to help them and they needed to help each other. And then that sort of transferred kind of naturally to include refugees among, people with needs. And then, you do have people who are themselves refugees who become volunteers who need something to do and want to help. So, I don't know, in some ways that's been kind of inspiring, but now that it's 3 or 4 years in, there's a lot of burnout and people have realized this is chronic.
Compassion fatigue, they call it.
Yeah, yes. And a lot of NGOs, they leave, because it's no longer sort of sexy. They can't get the money in, or, it's not in the news. And then what happens is, a camp is depending on some large NGO and it just sort of pulls up stakes. But I think one of the things the government has at least done is not get in the way of that. I mean, it has at least done that much of not getting in the way of things like squats and volunteers and these.
Well,
kind of,
it's one form of small government, yes. That if there is no government.
Yeah. Yes. So I don't know.
Did you find that these experiences were altering your work, your poetry?
Yes. I don't really think of myself as a political poet, but I did find myself writing more poems about what was happening, and those, I guess, are essentially political. And I also started looking at poets like Byron, who are writing about politics and current events, but doing this in a very lively, literary fashion. So I was kind of looking also to models for how to grapple with things that are happening now instead of things that you had a long time.
That's very interesting, because nobody really writes in a Byronic style now, and they haven't for a long time, which is a sort of high rhetorical, very Augustan 18th century sort of feel. But the figure, of course, of Byron still occupies a perhaps too large place in people's imagination when it comes to thinking of Greece, especially modern Greece.
Well, I would dispute that, actually. I mean, I think this is one of these things where Byron is a kind of exaggerated and hyperbolic and almost humorous figure.
But he was in his own time, I think.
English letters,
yes.
And American letters. But in Greece, he is considered a major hero of the revolution. And I think there's an understanding in Greece that his efforts were important and, had a very strong bearing on things. I was just at a poetry festival 2 nights ago where a Greek poet read an ode to Byron. There's Byron Street, there's a neighborhood, Virona. Byron is a not uncommon name to give your Greek child. So I think he's actually, he's a major figure here and is considered an important war hero.
That's an interesting point of connection then, in the way that you're describing with the Hesiod, that current experiences echo ancient concerns and current political and poetic concerns echo, you know, the earlier part of modern Greek history. The new collection you have out is called Like. Why is it called Like?
Well, of course, you know, we are used to hearing the word like all the time with social media. I think I wanted to reclaim like for the poets from the social media. I like is a very important word for poets because it's the hinge of every simile. Mm. And it can be any part of speech. It was pointed out to me that like is a good old Scottish word of Scottish origin.
Really? I didn't know at all.
I didn't know that either.
How did that change your use of it?
I wanted the idea of a sort of short title, and I have a poem, you know, called Like, which deals with how we put like into every phrase, or some people do. We try to resist it. But I think it was largely, you know, trying to reclaim this word from its Facebook usage.
Yes, it does. It does give me a mental image of the little thumbs up or a little heart symbol or something that you click on. Could we hear the reclaiming of the word like, if you like?
Okay. Well, the good thing about this the volume when I'm looking for poems is that they're in alphabetical order.
So. It's around the middle. You'll find it somewhere
yes.
around the middle.
So this poem, it's a sestina. Sestinas are notorious among poets as being difficult to write, but also often being kind of boring.
Don't say that.
The problem is with the sestina, I think, is not just that it's six stanzas with certain words that get repeated at the end of each line. So there are six words, which are called repetens, that come at the end of each line in the stanza, and they change around in this complicated permutation that I'm sure you can write a mathematical formula about.
Well, I'm not sure if I could, but someone could, yeah.
And I think it's often thought that the problem with it is, you know, getting all of these words repeating into it. And it just occurred to me that we actually repeat words all of the time in speech. That's pretty natural. So the problem maybe with the poem is, or the form, is that it's 39 lines. So you have to have a kind of a rant going on, so this is a bit of a rant. So this is called Like the Sestina. Now we're all friends, there is no love but like, a semi-demi-goddess, something like a reality TV star look-alike named Simile or Me Too. So we like in order to be liked. It isn't like there's love or hate now. Even plain dislike is frowned on, there's no button for it. Like is something you can quantify. Each like you gather's almost something money-like, token of virtual support. Please like this page to stamp out hunger, and you'd like to end hunger and climate change alike. But it's unlikely. Like does diddly. Like just twiddles its unopposing thumbs up. Likewise props up. Scarecrow silences. I'm like so over him, I overhear, but like he doesn't get it. Like, you know, he's like, it's all okay. Like, I don't even like him anymore. Whatever. I'm all like, take like out of our chat, we'd all alike flounder agape, gesticulating like a foreign film sans subtitles, fall like dumb phones to mooted desuetude. Unlike with other crutches, when we use like, we're not just buying time on credit. Like displaces other words, crowds cuckoo-like, endangered hatchlings from the nest. Click like if you're against extinction. Like is like invasive zebra mussels, or it's like those nutria things, or kudzu, or belike redundant fast food franchises, each like more like the next. The poets who dislike inversions, archaisms, who just like plain English as she spoke. Why isn't like there literally every other word? I'd like us just to admit that's what real speech is like. But as you like, my friend, yes, we're alike how we pronounce, say, lichen and dislike cancer and war. So like this page. Click like.
Well, I like that, and I'll be definitely clicking on the like button for that. And if anyone listening likes that, then they know that the book Like is out now. Alicia Stallings, thank you so much.
Thank you.